Hi, today is June 18th, 2016. This is Movies Podcast number 163. I'm Todd Goss Award, my good friend John Westfall. And after a brief hiatus, what was our hiatus? One weekend?
One or two weekends, something like that.
Yeah. Well, I was off traveling a bit. I went to the UK to go visit my daughter, who had spent a semester there in a study abroad program. And we are now both back in a good old U.S. But a couple of interesting travel items, or actually related travel items while I was there that's tech-related, especially mobile tech-related, is as some of you, all five of our listeners, may recall, our regular listeners may recall, I switched from T-Mobile to Google Fi, when was it, last July or August, I guess, of 2015. And one of the features that Google Fi uses T-Mobile as one of its two U.S. carriers. It's a Fi does not have its own network. It's an MVNO, mobile virtual network operator, and it uses T-Mobile U.S. and Sprint to provide cell data SMS service. In any case, one of the benefits of being a T-Mobile user and being a Google Fi user is when you travel internationally in areas where T-Mobile has service, as it does in the UK, Google Fi also has service at a much discounted rate. Basically, you pay the same amount as you do in the US. So voice is free, SMS is free, and you pay $10 per gigabyte, which is great. So and the last time I went to the UK in April, when I was mostly in Scotland, it worked, you know, fine. I mean, T-Mobile coverage is an issue, like it is in the U.S., basically, at least for me. But where it had coverage, it worked fine. So not quite last week, but week and a half ago, I guess, in past week, I'm meeting my daughter at a what they call a coach station, a bus station. She was busing on down from her university in England to London to meet me, and we spent the week there and before heading home. So I'm walking over to the coach station, or starting to walk over to the coach station. I fire up Google Maps on my Nexus 6 using T-Mobile UK, and I get nothing. I try to go to a browser, I get nothing. Basically, I have no data, and I have no idea why, because it worked fine earlier that day. So, and I should also know, I've never been to London before. So, I'm walking over to a bus station, and fortunately, I'd made a practice run that morning. I walked the park and found my way to Victoria Station just to make sure I knew where to go, you know, whatever. And I'm thinking, now what do I do? Well, fortunately, the hotel I'm staying in, which I believe is called the Park Grand Paddington Hotel, which is just a few blocks north of Hyde Park, had a very interesting guest, what do you want to call it, feature, amenity, that's what I'm looking for, amenity. When I walked into the room in the hotel the day before, there on the nightstand, you know, along with the usual guest stuff, was an Android phone propped up on a stand and being charged up. And there's a sign next to it that says, this is a Handy, H-A-N-D-Y, that's a brand. This is a Handy phone. It has free voice, free text, and unlimited data. Feel free to use it during your stay here. Not a particularly fast phone. And it was limited to 3G. Didn't have LTE. But for the heck of it, I had decided to turn it on. And basically, it erases itself after your stay. Or you can erase it yourself, as I did before I left. But you can configure it with your accounts, blah, blah, blah. So I had configured it. Just for the heck of it, as a backup, and I was carrying it as I was walking the bus station. So I put away my Nexus 6, pulled out this Handy phone, this Android free phone that the hotel had provided, fired up Google Maps, and continued on my way. It was really handy. If you're interested, the URL for the company that provides these phones to hotels is Handy, H-A-N-D-Y, .travel, T-R-A-V-E-L. That's it. That's the full URL. It's a .travel domain. So, it's the first hotel I've ever been in. It provided a phone as an amenity. I mean, TV, yeah. Radio now and then, yeah. So that was quite nice. I don't know, John, you ever been to a hotel with a provided a full
cell phone? I've not seen that. I like the idea. I really think it's a win-win for everyone. You know, you've got travelers from out of the country that don't necessarily have data access, don't have phone access. I'm sure the monetization in this is that the hotel probably pays a small fee, and there's probably ads that are you know, subsidizing the rest of it.
Right.
And so it seems like a really nice compromise for everyone, a win-win all around. So I really like this idea. I hope it starts popping up in more and more places.
Yeah, I should note that ads on the phone are very unobtrusive. They weren't like, you know, those annoying pop-ups that we see here in the U.S. On our regular mobile phones. It never bothered me at all. You know, from a visual point of view or usage point of view, never got in the way. I never felt like I had to clear a pop-up or something. In fact, there weren't any pop-ups, but I never had to clear an ad just to go see what I was trying to do to, you know, go find my daughter or anything. So that was really neat. And the other thing is, I don't know how popular prepaid plans are in Europe in general, but if when people from, even from, you know, just across the pond, or not across the pond, but across the channel from the UK visit there, I know my daughter's prepaid plan, and she couldn't get a regular plan there because she had no EU or UK credit card. She had to get a prepaid while she was a student there. Her prepaid card only worked in UK, so it didn't work in Europe, you know, continental Europe, and it didn't work in the Republic of Ireland, which is not part of the UK. Northern Ireland is, but Republic of Ireland isn't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you've got a prepaid plan, having a free plan while you're in, you know, in London is a really handy thing to have, even if you live just a few hundred kilometers across the channel. Which isn't that big, actually, but you know what I mean. So that was pretty neat. And, I should also mention a hotel, which is, you know, I guess it's, you would call it a boutique hotel. It wasn't very large. But the hotel, when I walked in, had a USB charger in the wall. And by that, I mean, you know, a USB port. Mm-hmm. A type A port that you can just plug your phone into as soon as you, you know, grab your charger cable and plug it into the wall and plug your phone in to recharge after a long trip. It had a number of video and audio I/O ports right next to it. In fact, I took a picture of it. I'll post it on the blog as part of our thing, part of our podcast. And so had I been carrying a notebook, you know, with HDMI and all of that, I could have watched videos and so forth, or toss my photos up on a big screen in the hotel room. Very, very handy little hotel, I have to say. Very business traveler and or in my case, you know, pleasure traveler friendly.
Well, that's, I'm glad that you had a good trip over there, and I'm glad you were able to scope out some of the technology that we don't know is even existing. It's always interesting to me when I take trips to find out what's going on, because I don't travel that often.
Yeah, me too.
And it seems like it's leaps and bounds. And then you go to a hotel that doesn't have something like USB ports.
Yeah.
And you go, what's wrong with this place?
Right.
This is something I've seen for about 5 years now.
Right. And then the other thing is the hotel. And this is, I've noticed, if you go to, and we may have mentioned this or discussed it before. My impression, at least in the U.S., you know, I'm not much of an international traveler. My impression in the U.S., is that the mid-range and even low-end hotels, and by low-end, I don't mean like, you know, dumps, but like, I don't know, Holiday Inn Express or Quintas, you know, those kind of places. By low-end, I mean they're not nice. They're nice hotels, but they're very inexpensive, very affordable. Like, it's affordable hotels, not low-end. The affordable and mid-range hotels tend to be the ones who have nice free Wi-Fi. It's the expensive hotels that make you pay. You're already paying more than you do at these other, you know, affordable hotels, and they make you pay for Wi-Fi. And I'm talking about you, Hilton, and to name names, which, you know, includes Embassy Suites and that sort of thing. So my preference is to stay at the affordable hotels because, A, they're affordable, and, B, they have free Wi-Fi, which makes them more affordable.
Yeah, they tend to work a little harder, and it's interesting. I can understand if you're a resort hotel that makes your money off of people staying on your property and at your property the majority of the time they're traveling, but if you are just a nice hotel that is a conference hotel or something like that, it always amuses me how much they seem to be into nickel and diming people.
Yeah, really annoying. In any case, so that's my travel story. I may have more later, but that's the one that really stuck out in my mind because it was such a... It was really not an emergency because I did have that spare phone in my pocket, but you can imagine if I had not had that phone.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I did make that dry run in the morning, so I kind of knew where it was, you know, without having to use Google Maps, but it would have been much more difficult an effort to go meet up with my daughter.
And I know there are people like you and I that make dry runs, but there are probably way more people that don't.
Yeah, exactly. The next item is something that was news to me, although apparently it's been there for months. Mm-hmm. And that's AT&T's Wi-Fi calling and number sync for iOS and other devices. And the reason I bring it up now is I happened to read a news item earlier this week that number sync, I'm sorry, Wi-Fi calling is now available for Android phones, some Android phones, on the AT&T network if you're an AT&T subscriber. And what Wi-Fi calling does is very familiar to T-Mobile users. Is that if you are on a Wi-Fi network at your home, office, or wherever, and you have this option turned on, and it's turned off by default, you have it turned on, you can receive calls on your phone via Wi-Fi. And this may not seem like much unless you live in an area with poor AT&T coverage. My home used to be one of those, by the way. I had no coverage inside of my home for many years until they put up a new antenna, a new tower, cell tower, not too far from my home a few years ago. So, or if you're, you know, you're like in a basement, if you're, and you need to, or in a large building, like anybody's been to Las Vegas knows about those large hotels where you lose connectivity in the middle of a hotel. I at least used to, I haven't been to Vegas in years, but it allows you to get phones and make phone calls, over Wi-Fi when you don't have your cell network available to you. Well, this has been on iOS apparently since iOS 9 last year, but I just didn't know it, so I turned it on recently. But more useful to me was another feature called Number Sync, whereas if you have other iOS devices like an iPad or an iPod Touch, for example, you can receive and make and originate calls from your non-phone device. So basically, if you have Number Sync turned on your iPhone, if you have an iPad and your phone is, you know, sitting upstairs or whatever, and you're in Wi-Fi, it can ring all your devices if you have more than one iOS device. And you can also use FaceTime to make an outgoing POTS call to, you know, another regular telephone. Not a FaceTime user, but just a regular telephone, like your home phone or whatever. So I turned both of those features on, and I don't know if I call them very useful, but it seems like it's very useful to me. I've never had the occasion to use it except for testing. And it does work fine. But I don't know, John, you don't use it. You're not on AT&T. You're on T-Mobile or something, right?
So I'm on Verizon.
Oh, Verizon, okay.
As you were talking about this, I thought of a very interesting issue. And that was that last year when this was announced in iOS 9, it was to be coming to Verizon at some point after the first of the year.
Okay.
And I had not heard anything since. And, of course, this is something that I'm really interested in because occasionally I go places where I don't have the best cell coverage.
Sure.
And so I thought, well, surely once this is available, it will make news headlines. I'll notice it, and I'll be able to get it all set up. And so as you were talking, I looked up. I'm like, gee, when is Verizon going to get their act together and do this?
Yeah.
And sure enough, it's now available. I have no idea how long it's been available, and I am going through the setup process right now for it on Verizon, where basically you turn it on, and then you tell it where your emergency address is in case you call 911.
Right.
And so I have Wi-Fi calling now turned on my phone. Would have been really nice to know about this when it actually came out. Who knows when it's been available for Verizon.
Same experience for me in AT&T, by the way. Apparently, it's been available for many months on AT&T. I just never knew about it.
Well, yeah, and I knew it was coming for iOS. It just is really interesting to me that this wasn't something that anyone bothered to mention at all when it finally did show up.
And for people who live in areas where their coverage at their home, for example, is not good, but you do have decent broadband, and Wi-Fi in your home. This is a great way to avoid getting a microcell in your home. You know, yet another thing to plug in.
Well, it's really funny. It looks like March 23rd was when it finally came out for Verizon, so I'm a little bit late. It launched with iOS 9.3. But anyway, my in-laws, where they live kind of in a area where if you go outside their house, you get coverage. As soon as you go in the house, it's just not strong enough coverage to get in the house, even on Verizon, which usually penetrates walls much better than these GSM networks. But anyway, they finally broke down last year, right about the time Verizon said, we're going to roll it out. My in-laws broke down and bought a microcell.
Oh, they did.
So I was able to use my phone there for the first time over the holidays last year, but it was still kind of a, gee, I wish I had Wi-Fi calling built in, especially when I'm in buildings and things like that on campus that, you know, our campus works pretty well with Verizon. We don't have a lot of tall buildings. We don't have a lot of basements. In fact, I don't know if we have any basements. So still, it's nice to have. I'm glad I now have it enabled. And, yeah, we'll see how useful it is.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it is, you know, when my daughter got home from running around, now that she's home for the summer, I picked up my iPad Pro Junior and I called her. Or actually, I called her home phone to make it more interesting because she knows that's how FaceTime works. Mm-hmm. So I called her home phone from an iPad and I held it up to my head like a big phone. And, you know, anyway, she was not all that amused, kids. Anyway, I was amused more than she was, to be honest.
Kids today, Todd. Yeah. Kids today.
Yeah. Okay, and the next item is what I call a head scratcher. And I don't know about you, John, but I still don't understand this one at all. Microsoft, in its infinite wisdom and, you know, string of successful large acquisitions over the past years, spent $26.2 billion, as the late Carl Sagan used to say, billions and billions of dollars, to buy LinkedIn. Do you get it? I don't get it. I really don't.
So all I can figure is that Satya Nadella got really sick of those LinkedIn Connect emails that we all get. Where, and it was, you know, LinkedIn wants to connect with you, not someone at LinkedIn. It was the whole site. And so he's just like, fine, I'll buy it already.
I'll connect with you, right?
Yeah, or he lost a bet. I mean, it's one of the two. Because I don't see – so we've had discussion in our group of friends about what exactly the benefits of this would be. Yes, I could see some benefits to it here and there, but I don't see $26.2 billion of benefits, especially when LinkedIn was valued at $10 billion less than that.
Right.
So it seems like Microsoft got a bad deal on this.
And it doesn't have a huge user base like Facebook or even Twitter, I think. And also doesn't have an active user base. At least it doesn't seem very active to me.
And it's not a user base that doesn't already overlap with a bunch of Microsoft products.
Right.
Because pretty much everyone on LinkedIn lists Microsoft Office as a proficiency of theirs.
Right.
So I can't imagine that these are people who have never heard of Microsoft technologies before and are really going to be keyed in and haven't Skyped before and haven't done any of the other things. So yeah, it's intriguing. It's confusing. Who knows? Maybe there's a point to it we just aren't seeing.
And, you know, I don't think either John – I'll speak for John even without asking. I don't think either John or I would claim to be merger and acquisition experts by any stretch. If we were, we wouldn't be doing a podcast. We'd be making millions of dollars in M&As.
Yep.
But Microsoft's track record – this is the largest purchase ever by far. Microsoft's track record of large acquisitions is not good. I mean, there was Nokia. They had to write all of that off, plus another billion or two. There's Aquantive, their online ad thing that they spent, I don't know, $6, $7, $8 billion on. That was total loss. It had to write that off completely. There's Skype, you know, which we're using right now, and it's still running, but they've really not done anything with it except use the branding for their former Microsoft Link product for business. And anybody who's used Skype for Business, as I have, knows it is nothing like Skype. At all. It's got a different UI. It's a different product. It just has the same brand name. And there, it probably goes on and on. You know, there are not very many successful large acquisitions that Microsoft has made. In fact, I can't think of any.
I will say at least they don't tend to kill products that users are actively using.
Is that true? Yeah, I think you're right.
Google will buy something and kill it.
Yeah, they'll kill it. Yeah, before it's ready to die sometimes.
Yeah. But Microsoft, they buy it and they let it languish for, you know, until everyone's pretty much left it naturally and gone to better products. I think of like Live Mesh years ago, whatever the folder sync and all that, that whole debacle. But pretty much everyone had migrated to Dropbox by then.
Right, because it's so
Microsoft
bad.
Killed it off. So they were really nice about that. And I think that's what they excel in. Microsoft is nice about when they kill off things. You've already left it years ago.
Yeah.
You don't miss it very much. Yeah. But
unlike Google.
Yeah, Google is spiteful in killing off things.
Yeah, well, they are Skynet. So
they are. But, you know, there's a Google Voice feature coming to iOS.
Oh, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yep.
So two short items, unless you have something else to say about this Microsoft LinkedIn thing, which neither of us apparently.
No one has much to say about it. Okay. No one can figure it out.
Except it's $26.2 billion.
Yeah. Well,
which is like three times more than anything else they've ever bought.
And it was more than they actually had in the country.
That's which is right.
Even better. They had to go, you know, take out some loans to get the money to buy it.
Yeah, Microsoft has much more than $26 billion in the bank, so to speak. But most of that cash, I think like $90 billion sitting offshore. So they literally didn't have enough money in the U.S. to make this in-U.S. purchase. So they're going to have to borrow money for it. They say it's a tax break, blah, blah, blah. But, oh, well.
Yeah.
You know, good story. I'm going to try to buy a large, you know, expensive car. Maybe I'll try to buy a Tesla and see if I can not pay any taxes on that too. I don't think so. Or the money I used for it. Anyway, two short items before we get to John's WWDC summary is one, a little bit late to the game, but the Amazon Echo Dot I ordered for my daughter finally arrived yesterday. I think I ordered in like April. Finally arrived. She really likes it. I have to say, you know, the built-in speaker, although tiny, is fine. I think, you know, for a dorm room or something like that, no problem. Of course, if you want a bigger sound, you can plug it in to a larger speaker or use a Bluetooth speaker. So, you know, there's that option if you want a bigger sound from it. But I think for a dorm room or a small apartment or something like that, it's just perfect. And I think the only thing that she's disappointed in is it isn't battery operated. You have to plug it into the wall. You need the Amazon Tap if you want something unplugged in. The second is what I call untip, something you cannot do. Is I found out yesterday, you know, Starbucks has granitas available. I know you don't have a Starbucks near you, John, but if you had one, you'd know that Starbucks has granitas available during the summer, which is kind of like a slush drink. So I decided yesterday afternoon to pop out of my office and walk a block down the street to Starbucks to get a granita. And I thought, well, I'll mobile order it so it's ready when I get there. And it turns out you cannot mobile order a granita.
That also sounds like someone lost a bet and said, fine, we won't put it in the app or something. That's a very confusing thing to not be able to do. But
yeah. One suggestion from a friend of mine was maybe because, you know, granitas, you know, because being like slushies might melt before you get there if you don't get there in time, which is, I guess that's reasonable.
But it sounds more like to me that they just, since the promotional option, it just didn't get added into the system.
Yeah. Although they're pretty good about feature drinks, so anyway. Mm-hmm. Not a huge problem. I enjoyed my first taste of a Starbucks granita. Okay. So the next item is I asked John, because I wasn't really following WWDC very closely. I know, and the few things I did didn't interest me, or, you know, I already have my Android phone, so I wasn't like, whatever. So John, what end user kind of new features did you find interesting announcements?
So, on Monday, WWDC launch time or keynote time, I told all of the people in my office at our staff meeting that it was happening, and they all looked at me like I was nuts because why would they care? And, of course, as academics and support staff, they didn't really care. But anyway, that didn't stop me from coming home and plopping down on the couch and watching the keynote, all 2 hours of it.
Oh, my God.
And there was a lot of stuff to talk about. In fact, this was one of the few that I've watched that didn't seem to have any kind of obligatory time filler sort of thing to it.
Yeah.
And very little about the actual programmatic things that this is a developers conference. So you're expecting to see, you know, a little bit of code, maybe a little bit of look at this API, a little bit of look at this. Very, very little of that. You know, none of the demos that we'd seen in past years. It was all end user sort of stuff.
Which is odd for developer keynote.
It is, but The developers, there are certain areas here where developers recognize the kind of power of what they were seeing. So, for example, iMessage is kind of the big one that everyone's been talking about. iMessage on iOS is getting bubble effects, full screen effects. You can kind of add some flair to your message. And while that is really cool, and while that will, I know a lot of, you can emojify things, you can tap on emojis, and anything that has an emoji will light up orange, and you can tap right away. And as Craig Federici joked, kids of tomorrow will have no idea what the English language is, because we're adding these emojis in one by one. But what the developers care about, rightly so, is the API opening up for iMessage. So a couple of the demos they showed were cute things like stickers and all that, but also the idea that you could, if you were ordering lunch for the office, have a group cart that everyone in the iMessage thread could add things to and then send off the order, and then presumably the developer of that app could have the order charged to, you know, individual parts to each person. So that's, I think, some of the powerful stuff that developers were kind of drooling over in iMessage, was now we can start adding things directly into message threads where people are interacting with each other.
So what are bubble effects, or full screen effects for that matter?
Bubble effects are things like, if you want your little word, like, you know, they showed a few of them. One of them was invisible ink. So you send it with invisible ink, and when the person receives it, the text is kind of shimmery, and you have to move your finger over it to actually unveil what the text says. So a way of getting, you know, nobody sees it until they actually open up the message. And so it's like the virtual scratch-off, you know. Another one was, you know, having the bubble get really big and show the word really huge for a couple seconds and then shrink back down to regular size. Another one was kind of the reverse of that, small and then getting bigger. So a way of, when you're sending messages, to convey a little bit more emotion instead of just the words coming through.
So it's like using Line.
Yeah, if you think about it, all of the stuff Apple really showed off were things that they saw other people doing really well and they stole.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the stuff in iMessage that they're building in is stuff that Facebook Messenger's had for a while now. So that, but bubble effects are that. Full screen effects are, you could have, you know, confetti rain down in the message window and stuff like that.
Yeah, and you know, I haven't seen it on mine yet, but apparently Facebook Messenger can now send SMS messages. Not on mine, but apparently somehow you can. Or will be able to.
Yep.
Interesting. Okay, so that's in competition with iMessage.
Yeah, iMessage, that was the big thing. Of course, on another fun thing I read last week, there was a rumor saying iMessage would be coming to Android. that's never happening. In fact, this week, Apple released a statement, or it was in one of the, it wasn't a statement, it was in an interview with someone in the higher-ups that basically said, you know what, we have a billion users on iMessage, so we can mine all the machine learning we want out of a billion people. Yeah. And really, this is a feature we think pushes people to iOS over Android. So we're not bringing it to Android, which was at least nice to see a company very honest about, this is a feature we value in our products that we're not letting everyone play with. Siri, the next big thing. So these are, everything else kind of wasn't as featured as the iMessage one, but it was all there. So Siri is getting further expanded, and importantly, an API is opening up so that if you would like to build an app that Siri could control or Siri could interact with, you'll have that option.
I think that's a really valuable new feature, by the way.
Yep. And again, the fun thing about this was WWDC. These are developers. That feature took about a minute for them to announce, and they didn't demo anything with it. It was just like, hey, we're going to have it for you. Enjoy.
Yeah.
I think a lot of developers are sitting there kind of going, wait, I want to nerdgasm over this a little more, that I'm going to have access to this. And you just moved on to something else. So OS X name is gone. Now we're at Mac OS officially is the new name. The new version will be Mac OS Sierra. And one of the features on it will be auto unlock. So same thing that your iPhone does to your Apple Watch now. This will be something will unlock your MacBook. And who knows if that, it looked like in the demo it was wearing an Apple Watch authenticated to your MacBook. That's another thing that I have an app for right now that will be obsoleted. Split screen Safari.
Wait, I want to go back. So basically auto unlock is Apple Hello.
Yeah, pretty much without having to say or do anything other than just open the the book. Yep.
And I have to say, you know, Windows Hello on the Surface Pro 4 works. Annoyingly well. I mean, I think I was just sitting down when I wasn't even facing the camera properly. Turned, you know, popped open the Surface. I was sitting down, so I was like sideways and, you know, maybe not my full head. And it said, yeah, I see you. I recognize you, and I'm unlocking.
And you're like, I don't want you to unlock right now. I don't want you to recognize me.
Yeah. It was a little unnerving, actually. It's a little too good, you know. But anyway, I'm sorry. Next item?
Yep, yep. Split screen Safari on the iPad. This is one that wasn't really highlighted. Right now, if you're on an iPad Pro or an iPad that can do split screen multitasking, can't have Safari up on both sides.
Ah, got it. Okay.
So now you can, and obviously that's pretty nice for power users.
It is.
A feature that literally they took 20 seconds to demo, which is something people have been looking for years, transcribed voicemail. Who knows how that's going to work, but something will be transcribing your voicemail messages, and you'll get a transcript just like Google Voice has provided to Google Voice users for 10 years now.
Yeah, and I have to say that Google Fi, which doesn't allow you to use Google Voice, by the way, Google Fi's voicemail transcription works pretty well, but I would have to say it fails about 33% of the time. Mm-hmm. It says no transcript available. Most of those are telemarketing calls and, you know, voicemail spam. But,
and if you think about it, now with transcribed voicemail, Wi-Fi calling, and an iPhone, you have pretty much all the features of Google Voice.
Yes, it took years, but here we are.
It's all there. So I think I feel better and better about my decision to start transitioning off Google Voice like I did about a year ago now. But we'll see. It's still alive.
Yeah.
For now,
I still use Google Voice a lot because I really like having the Google Voice interface in the web, you know, versus my phone. When my daughter was away in the UK, we switched to Line because it seemed to work better for international kinds of messaging. Mm-hmm. But I still use Google Voice a lot, and I don't know what to do because nothing else has all the features of Google Voice yet, including web access.
Unless you're on a completely Mac world.
I guess so, which I'm not. Yeah.
Get your text messages forwarded to messages on your MacBook, and then you can send back out through your iPhone.
Yeah. So. The problem with Line, by the way, for the weird among us have multiple phones and multiple devices, it can only be associated with one phone number and one phone device. So you can't have it on both Android and, you know, the same account on Android and iPhone, for example, and I know that's an odd use case, but more importantly, it can only be on one tablet, so you can't have it on, say, a Windows tablet, you know, which might be your PC, like my Surface in my case, and an iPad. So, and if you have two iPads, like iPad Mini and iPad Pro, you have to choose which one gets the Line access at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
not the most friendly thing on the planet.
No, but it is a good service other than that,
mm-hmm.
And very, it's been pretty reliable. Anyway, next up.
Interactive notifications. This is primarily useful if you have a 6S or a 6 Plus or 6S Plus, in that you can force tap down on something, and instead of just dismissing it, it'll pop up a message for reply. This is on the lock screen, these notifications. So that's kind of a cool feature, and those will be available to iPhone 6 users, just assuming a different interface since you don't have force press on the 6 or 6 Plus.
Yeah.
Photos app copied a lot of features from the Replay Video app, so now your photos can get set to music, and you can specify the theme you want with that and create little videos. And Google Photos. Photos are going to start identifying faces and things like that. So if you have Replay and Google Photos, you've enjoyed this for years, the photo app is catching up. Apple Watch demo launched apps, according to Apple, 7 times faster on average. Why? Because they're actually doing background refresh of apps and keeping them kind of in background so that when you launch them, if they're your frequently used apps, they're not launching from nothing. They have kind of a background running process.
So how fast is launching an app in Apple Watch? Is it? And by that I don't mean in seconds, but is it noticeably slow and annoying, or is it not too bad?
It's noticeably slow and annoying.
Oh, okay.
It's a good 4 or 5 seconds.
Wow.
To launch an app. Yeah, that's been the number one complaint for Apple Watch since it launched. And that was why this was actually the first thing they demoed in the keynote, was Apple Watch launching an app.
I should note, I ask because I'm not an Apple Watch user. I have Android Wear Watch. I have a Moto 360, the first generation Moto 360. And one of the things I learned a week or two ago is it has, you know, like many Android products, even though it's only, what, 2 years old, mm-hmm. it will not be getting the next major update, Android Wear 2.0 or whatever it is.
And Apple Watch will be getting its update, the first gen. No talk of second gen Apple Watch yet. In fact, there was no hardware discussion at all at WWDC. But the rumor is now that we might be seeing a new Apple Watch launching in the fall. But who knows? That'll be interesting to watch to see if that comes true.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that's one of the nice things about going with Apple hardware products, at least in my experience, is that they tend to support their products with updates for a very long time. In fact, I think, for example, the iPad 2, which was released in 2011, I think iOS 10, launching later this year, will be the first time the iPad 2 is not being going to be able to be upgraded.
Yeah, and to echo that, at my office, at one of my offices right now, because I'm kind of splitting time between two buildings, I have a mid-2009 MacBook Pro.
Uh-huh.
It is running El Capitan, and it's running it without any major problem. I've been using it as my daily worker when I'm over in that building. And it will get macOS Sierra.
Nice.
It'll be the last time it gets it, but I looked at the cutoff, and the cutoff is for early 2009 MacBook Pros. And I looked at my About tab, and I am a mid-2009
MacBook Pro. I don't even know what MacBook I'm running. Pro. I'm going to check while you keep talking.
And I'll, since we're talking about app launch speed, I will launch a random app on my phone. So I just tapped it. It's one password. It's loading. It's loading. It's loading. It's loading. It's loading. It's still loading. Still loading. Come on. Come on. Load up. It's not there. There it is. So if someone were to time my dialogue there, you'd know how long it took for one password to load up.
Yeah, that was kind of slow.
Let's see.
Oh, I just wanted to mention, I fired out the About box on my MacBook Pro, and it is also a mid-2009 device, so.
Well, then you can get OS or macOS Sierra.
Yeah.
When it's out later this year.
Yeah. We can and we can also be looking forward to not having people say OS X anymore.
Yes. Yes, that's true. We can, and it, honestly, it's a logical thing because I'm pretty sure everyone had been saying macOS for a while now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like everybody says iTouch. Nobody says iPod Touch.
Yeah, yeah. Apple TV, the biggest update for that is single sign-on. So right now, if you have an Apple TV and you have a cable TV provider, if you download, say, the ESPN channel, you have to authenticate the ESPN channel. And right. You have to do that by going to a web page, and it's a pain. And if you download any other app, you have to do that for each app. However, in the next major version, you'll have single sign-on. So once you authenticate one time, all of the apps that are available to you, you'll see them on a screen. You can pick the ones you want. So that's a very nice feature for Apple TV. Apple TV, there was nothing explicitly that said it was going to have any kind of HomeKit integration, but that's something that everyone has sort of started to assume that will eventually show up on Apple TV. HomeKit, I didn't even talk about on my list, but it got a major announcement during the keynote, and that there will be a HomeKit app. So one app that can control all of your HomeKit devices.
One app to rule them all.
Yes. On the programming side, Swift Playgrounds is how to teach kids how to program in Swift. It's an app that was demoed for about 10 minutes at the keynote. Basically, what separates it from the other Learn to Program apps that I've seen and played with is that kids are actually writing real Swift code. These aren't just little blocks of or little pseudo code. What you see is actual Swift code. Now, granted, the first demo, you're using two functions that are, you know, defined functions and things like that. But still, if you were to play through all the lessons, you would learn how to program in Swift. So that seems to be a very cool thing to get young people into programming more so than in the past.
Now,
and
I
that
found
will
it,
run on an iPad.
Yeah, I found it interesting that it runs on an iPad. I guess it's a cheaper, more readily available platform than a MacBook or iMac, but still.
Well, let's just talk about how intense it is to try to get your coding environment up and running on Mac OS. I mean, you have to download Xcode, which, while thankfully is everything in one bundle, it's a 5 gigabyte bundle. And so it is not a trivial, whereas Android, yeah, you've got a bunch of moving pieces to get your development environment up. This is a very much more leaner way. I could see, for example, in a few years, my wife and I have, her brother is expecting, so we'll have a niece joining the family in September. I could see in a few years, you know, with a 3 or 4 year old saying, you know, how do I use technology? I'm not going to fire up Xcode, but I'll fire up something like this and let them see the little guy hopping around, and we can play around with the programming and stuff like that.
Or you could have a genius, you know, and say, Uncle John, what is this playground stuff? Give me Xcode.
I will be very happy if my niece wants to play with Xcode at 4 years old, Todd. We will definitely make sure that happens. And then other things, you can now remove unwanted stock apps. You can delete them. You don't have to have an Apple junk drawer anymore for the majority of the stock apps that are built on. If you want them again, you can go back to the App Store and download them again.
Yeah.
But there's a caveat with this, and it's a perfectly logical programmatic caveat, but I could see people going, that's how Apple gets you. If you say delete Apple Maps, and then you use a piece of software that has a hook for Apple Maps, right, so it's going to show you a map, you won't get that functionality. It will break that out. So
that makes sense, though.
It won't just automatically pull Google Apps or pull something else. Right. You deleted Apple's Apple solution, and they are going to make you pay for that. So, yep, you can get rid of the stock apps, but you might not want to get rid of all of them.
You know, I should mention that on the Android side, you know, they're introducing something in the next version of Android N, which, and I'm calling, what did I call? I forget already. But Nameless McNutface. But at any rate, Android N is going to have something called Instant Apps, where an app can be downloaded and used from the web and then disappears from your Android device. So that would actually be pretty useful on an iOS device if you've uninstalled a stock app and now need it temporarily. If it had an instant app, that'd be a pretty useful feature.
Mm-hmm.
But not happening.
And the last thing that I have is Slide to Unlock.
Yeah, you got to explain that to me. How is that going to be gone?
It's gone. There's no more sliding to unlock. The button will now simply read on the home screen, press home to unlock.
Huh.
And so, and that's if you don't have Touch ID set up. If you have Touch ID set up, now when you lift your phone up, your phone will turn on. So the accelerometer will turn the screen on to just view. And if you put your finger on the sensor, it'll go straight to the home screen. So with Touch ID becoming omnipresent, slide to unlock was not much needed, because if you don't have Touch ID, press the home button and it will show you your unlock screen. If you have Touch ID, just put your finger on the button, don't even press it in, and you'll unlock.
I wonder if the lift to display the screen is going to kill the battery life on iOS, on some iOS devices, especially older ones.
Well, I have to see. That's an interesting possibility. The reason it was implemented, as they explained, was that the problem with Touch ID being so fast is that you don't see your notifications.
Yeah, that happens to me all the time.
And so this was, well, this way at least, as long as you don't pick it up by the Touch ID sensor, you'll see your notifications before they get dismissed automatically. Yeah. So,
you know, my Nexus 6, which does not have Touch ID, unlike Nexus 6P, I guess. But my Nexus 6 has the lift to turn on the display, and it's kind of annoying, actually, because a lot of times I'll, you know, pick it up to put it in a bag or something, and the screen will go on. I don't know if the battery, and the battery life on the Nexus 6 is nowhere as good as the iPhone 6, which I purchased around the same time. They're both about the same age. But, you know, I don't know if that contributes to it. I haven't really tried to turn it off. It'll be interesting to say, you know, I should note that while I was traveling, I was really surprised that both my iPhone 6, which I kind of, 6 Plus, and the Nexus 6 did quite well battery-wise, you know, considering I was using those things a lot, for especially for maps. Mm-hmm. During the day, while I was in the UK. And I should note, the Nexus was, you know, fully powered up with all the radios turned on. The iPhone 6 Plus was in airplane mode, but I did have Wi-Fi and GPS turned on, which you can still use without any cellular service. But anywho, Okay. And you also note in the last item list, as you said, the Game Center is one.
Yeah. Slide to Unlock is gone, and so is the useless Game Center app.
Thank
you. So Game Center doesn't go away. It's still built into games, and you still have leaderboards and all that within a game, but you don't have a central app to see your friends and all that, because really no one uses it.
No one uses it. And in fact, I don't get that whole thing because, you know, one of my favorite games, Civilization Revolution, keeps nagging you to log into the Game Center, and when you do, there's nothing. They even took away the leaderboards a while back. So there's not even leaderboards to look at in Civilization Revolution, which you could do in the earlier version.
Yeah.
So I don't
know. So who knows?
And I should also mention, Civilization Revolution 2 is a waste of money. The original is far better, much more playable.
So, yeah, that's my WWDC roundup. Okay. What was interesting about this year, like I said, was very little emphasis on program abilities and APIs and this and that, but much more emphasis on end-user features. So it was a pretty packed keynote. If you've got 2 hours to spend, I'd recommend watching it. Okay. If you like Apple products, because unlike previous years, you won't have the 15, 20 minutes of company-wide updates. And then, you know, at the end, like 30, 40 minutes of stuff you don't care about. It's pretty packed in.
All right. Thanks for that rundown, because like I said, I really didn't pay that much attention to WWDC this year. I probably should have. Okay, this has been Mobile Geeks Podcast number 163. Thanks for listening to all 5 of our regular listeners.
Mm-hmm.
We hope to have a 6th join us any day now. I will talk to you next time.